I'll turn it on and then I'll say good morning. So you all know by now that we really like snow in our household and love a good snowy winter. But after yesterday with the 61 degrees and sunny, I could go for spring. So we got out to the park and played and just had a nice day. So it's good to be together this morning to center our minds on the Lord and worship together, break bread together, sing together. I hope our time studying His Word is a blessing to you. For our visitors, we as a church have been reading through Luke the last few weeks, and tomorrow we kick off into Acts, and our goal is to just read and reread Luke and Acts the first 3 months of this year, and really asking the question, what does it mean to follow Jesus? What does it really mean to be His disciple? So that's been our focus, and trying to use opportunities with lessons to tie into some of those things. And so a couple weeks ago, we looked at Jesus' mission and noticed, you know, a few things that really stand out in Luke, His miracles, His meals, His message, and the things that Jesus was doing and spending His time in. And in all of that, the priority for Him was the message. There were, as good as the miracles were, as good as the meals were, and all the good that accomplished, there's something that's even more powerful and more beneficial about this message, this word that He was proclaiming. And then last week we looked at really just the fundamental mode of discipleship, fundamental mode of following Jesus, hear and do. As disciples, we just are sitting at Jesus' feet, constantly craving, eager to soak up everything He has to say, everything He's teaching. And we're also ready to obey, ready to imitate, trying to be like Jesus. So it's not just that we're just reading our Bibles every day. It's that we're sitting at Jesus' feet, wanting to learn, wanting to be changed to reflect Him and be like Him. And so this morning, I want to talk, if last week was just the mode of discipleship, this morning I want to talk about our commitment. And look at what Jesus expects of all disciples in regards to commitment. But I want to think together before we look at a text. I want to think together with you. As you've been reading through Luke, do you see a difference between Jesus' priorities and values and your own? I mean, just think about that. As you've been reading through Luke the last few weeks, you see a difference between Jesus' priorities and values and your own. Do you see a difference between the things Jesus was saying, the things that you're doing? Now, when I say that, I don't mean, are you living up to His example perfectly? Let's just get that out of the way. That's not going to happen. So I'm not talking about, are you living up to His example perfectly? I'm talking about your fundamental worldview in comparison to His. You know, the things that He was about, are you about those same things? Are your thinking, your priorities, your values, the depth of your commitment even close to the example that we're seeing in Jesus? I know for myself, personally, just the last year, I've been just confronted with, man, I just missing some important things of really what it means to follow Jesus in terms of commitment and focus, and can look in my heart and know, yeah, I've held back. I know I've held back. But the thing is, Jesus demands more, and He deserves more. And that's what we need to see. When we really realize who He is, then the response, the commitment, the follow-up, that becomes much more natural. I'm concerned that we, and I don't just mean me, we specifically, but just in general, we accept this sort of comfort gospel. We would condemn the health and wealth gospel. We'd condemn the social gospel, any other false gospels. But somewhere along the way, I fear that we've accepted this comfort gospel. We've said, in effect, join the right church, keep the right rules, attend services a few times a week. As long as you keep that up, God's pleased with your faith. But Jesus didn't talk like that. You're not going to see that kind of rhetoric in what Jesus was saying. Jesus unashamedly and unreservedly said, I get all of you or you get none of me. That's the sentiment we see in our Lord. Jesus demands our all, not just first place in our lives, but every place in our lives. Do you see that as you're reading through the Gospels? Large crowds did not impress Jesus. You read through and you see
so many different points in his ministry. I mean, he was extremely popular. Large crowds would travel great distances to hear him teach, to be healed by him. And but Jesus was never satisfied with this. Jesus never looked at the crowds and said, "You know, I'm glad so many people have made it out today. I'm thankful your faith is so great that you travel so far to hear me preach. You've really counted the cost, and I can see your love for God." He just didn't respond that way. Attendance and hearing a sermon was not the metric by which Jesus measured success or faithfulness. No, in fact, when he saw a large crowd, he cranked it up a notch or two. Or we could even say cranked it up 10 notches. He began to deliberately speak in ways to send the crowds away or convince people not to follow him. If you would open up to Luke 14, the passage that Micah just read for us. Want to dig into this text. There's a few places we could go to observe this, but I think this is probably one of the strongest that we'll find. I mean, I thought about just even looking at Luke 8 again, the parable of the sower. You know, large crowds come and Jesus just starts telling stories without explaining them, right? That's a good way to keep a crowd. Or you think about Luke 9, when you've got this series of would-be followers. Someone said, "I'll follow you wherever you go," and Jesus responded, "Hey man, I don't have any place to sleep tonight." You know, that's not going to get somebody to want to follow him. Or the very next account, you've got a guy saying, "Let me just bury my father first." Jesus says, "Let the dead bury their dead. You go proclaim the gospel of the kingdom." Or he said, "Let me at least just go say goodbye to my parents." He said, "No one putting their hand on the plow and looking behind is fit for my kingdom. It's worthy for his kingdom." So over and over, we see this sort of thing where, again, Jesus wasn't interested in the crowds. He would send them away. He would talk them out of following him. But look in Luke 14, and let's just read the first couple verses there, verse 25 and 26. It says, "Now large crowds were going along with him, and he turned and said to them, 'If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple.'" Hate your family. That's a really warm, like, way to welcome a crowd and warm up a crowd, isn't it? A little different than, I come up here and I start talking about sunshine and snow, and Jesus says, "Hate your family." He's not saying hate literally. In fact, you guys have a footnote, or look in your Bibles, see if you have a footnote there next to the word hate in verse 26. Probably, mine says something like, "In other words, by comparison of his love for me." The translators want us to make sure we understand this isn't literal hate. His point is our love for him must be so great that our care for our closest family will seem like hate in comparison. That he is supremely first in our lives, and there's no rivals. I think that's his point. But he doesn't say it like that. Think about that. Again, his point is we don't literally hate other people, but he speaks in such a way to rattle us, to rattle the crowds. Listen to this again. "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." Let that just sink in and think about that unfiltered. He said he cannot be my disciple. Jesus is deliberately forceful and jarring. The next verse would also rattle the crowd. Look at verse 27. "Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." Sometimes we'll hear the phrase, that's my cross to bear. In other words, that's this burden I have to carry in this life. But that's not the idea of cross in the first century. A cross was not a burden to bury, a burden to carry. A cross was an instrument of shameful, violent, torturous death. Jesus isn't saying, "Bear a little burden for me." Jesus says, "Embrace a shameful, violent, torturous death for me." In all this, hating family, carrying a cross, Jesus is emphatic. He says, if you do not do this, you cannot be my disciple. You see that twice there in those two verses? Again, this would offend the crowds. This would rattle the crowds. And I think if we're honest, this offends us too and rattles us. Even though we've heard these things before, when we really stop and think about it, do you really like that? But Jesus helps us reason through these challenges, these demands in the next few verses. Let's pick up in verse 28. He says, for which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he's laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who observe it begin to ridicule him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. He gives another parable. Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and consider whether he's strong enough with 10,000 to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other's still far away, he'll send a delegation and ask for terms of peace. So Jesus follows up these radical, intense demands with two parables that are essentially challenging us to count the cost. Each parable, you'll probably notice, comes at it from a different perspective. The first is basically calling us to ask, can I afford to follow Jesus? The second one, though, is challenging us to ask, can I afford not to follow Jesus? So you think about this first parable. When you build, you make sure you have enough to finish the project before you start building. It'd be foolish to begin building without a budget. When I was working as a landscape architect, I mean, even you know, whether you're talking about a campus project we were working on or high-end residential. I mean, so let's take our high-end residential clients. I mean, multi-millionaires that are going to spend millions of dollars on whatever this is that we and the architects are working on, they still had a budget. You know, even though they've got plenty of money, they still wanted to make sure not only they could afford to do that what we were giving them was valuable to them. So we get the principle, right? You don't sit down and build something without stopping and saying, you know, am I willing to pay this? Jesus wants us to be aware of the cost up front so we don't quit halfway. He wants us to finish. Jesus doesn't want us saying, you know, I didn't know that meant I couldn't date him. Didn't know that meant I had to stay married to her. Didn't know that meant my parents or brothers or neighbors might end up hating me. I didn't know that meant I had to talk about my faith. Jesus is up front. He's transparent about the cost, about his demands, about his expectations. There's no fine print, absolutely no fine print when it comes to following Jesus. And so he says, if you don't have enough to pay, don't begin building the tower. But Jesus also wants us to be aware of the cost of not following him. And so he pictures this king, right? You know, a king who's you know, got 10,000 troops. If he's got another king coming against him with 20,000, he's going to stop and think, man, can I take this guy on? No, and if he realizes I can't, he's going to, while he's still a long way off, do whatever he can to make peace. Jesus is helping us see we're up against the king of the universe. And we need to decide if we've got enough to take him on. So can you afford to follow Jesus? Can you afford not to follow Jesus? Either way, we've got to count the cost. And so in verse 33, after he sort of challenged us to reason through those things, he gets back to these demands in verse 33. So then none of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions. Again, notice how Jesus is emphatic. None of you can be my disciple who does not do this, who does not give up all his possessions. And a little bit later in Luke, in Luke 18, we'll see the rich ruler, and Jesus literally told him, sell all you possess and give to the poor. Fundamentally, for all disciples, we're saying everything we possess is repurposed for his glory. We're giving up all rights and clinging to these things, giving it up for him. We give up all claim to all we possess for His kingdom and His glory. And we see this throughout Luke and Acts. I mean, think about Zacchaeus. The first thing he says is, Lord, half my possessions I'll give to the poor in Luke 19. Or you think about what we'll see tomorrow when we're reading through Luke 2 and the disciples selling property and possessions to share with those who had need. Or in Acts 4, disciples selling property and possessions to give with those who had need. Luke 8, a little bit earlier in Luke, you think about this picture of Jesus and His disciples traveling and the disciples and women. And it says there were people contributing to their support out of their private means. You think about disciples who use their homes for hospitality. Again, possessions, using it for the glory of the Lord. And Lydia, a great example of this in Acts 16. Or disciples who use their resources and talents to serve the needy, like Tabitha in Acts 9. Again, we may or may not need to literally sell everything we possess to follow Jesus. But we must give up all we possess for the purposes of the King and His kingdom. My money, my house, my stuff is all meant to serve His pleasure, not my pleasure. And so Jesus concludes with one more parable. Let's pick up in verse 34. It says, therefore, salt is good, but even if salt has become tasteless, with what will it be seasoned? It's useless, either for the soil or for the manure pile. It's thrown out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. He says, salt's good. But tasteless salt, he just says, you just check it out. You throw it away. You see this imagery in the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus is describing our influence. He's using salt as a metaphor for our influence in the world. Here he's using the same imagery, but using it to describe not our influence, but our commitment. It says, if we'll not hate our families, carry our cross, and give all our possessions, Jesus says, we're tasteless salt and useless for Him. He says, if you don't have the saltiness, if you don't have the commitment to go to the cross with me, what can I do with you? I can't even throw you in soil or the manure pile because He says you'd ruin that. That just brings a smile to your face, doesn't it? Just a cheery thought. Jesus says you would ruin manure. Even we're thinking about manure in the sense of fertilizer and its benefit to prevent growth, either way, that's a rattling image, isn't it? Jesus telling me that I would ruin manure. Does that bother you? Make you feel uncomfortable? I'm not this bold to just say these things. If I wasn't reading from the text, I wouldn't come up with this stuff. I'd rather just talk about sunshine and snow. But this is what Jesus hits us with. How do you think the crowds responded to this message? We're not told here. Other occasions in the Gospels, we read about the crowds being upset, even His own disciples being upset by what Jesus said. You think about John 6, the eat my flesh, drink my blood speech, and they just say, this is too much. We can't take it anymore. And they're out. And He's just left with the 12, and He says, would you going to go away too? But Peter's response, at least in John 6, was, you have the words of eternal life. Where else would we go? And so again, in this context, we're not told. We're simply left with the booming echo of these demands of Jesus. So again, let's just step back and think about some things that we see in a text like this. One is that Jesus wants everyone, but not just anyone. He died for everyone. We need to understand, He came to die for everyone. He wants everyone to come to Him. But He doesn't want just anyone to follow Him. Jesus could draw large crowds, but Jesus sought to make disciples. Jesus didn't want a crowd. Jesus wanted disciples. And Jesus wanted disciples who would follow Him to death if need be. Our goal is not to increase attendance. Our goal is to increase disciples committed to Jesus. And with that, hopefully we multiply. But the goal is disciples committed to Jesus. Jesus preferred a handful of people willing to surrender all rather than thousands of people willing to offer a nominal commitment. I think we set the bar too low. for ourselves. Or sometimes we're not even looking at the right bar. Jesus doesn't beg us to follow him. But by his grace, he calls us to follow him. And if we're on the fence, if we're unsure about the cost, unsure about the commitment, he'll try to talk us out of it. Have you ever done that? Have you ever tried to talk someone out of following Jesus? I've heard of preachers who will, you know, if a kid comes to be baptized and he's really, really young, he'll try and do that, if just make sure he knows what the commitment is. I've never heard of somebody sitting down with a convert, someone that they're trying to teach, and saying, you know, I don't know that you want to do this. Really pressing on that. And I have to admit, I'm tempted a lot of times to do the opposite. I've been tempted to soften Jesus' demands. I think about the times when I'm walking people through the Gospels, or just answering questions about suffering, answering questions about marriage and divorce. Man, you want to just ease the blow and maybe just minimize the word, soften what Jesus is actually saying, and make it a lot more palatable than what it really is. But I can't do that. If I do, you know, and think about this. If I do that and I soften it and minimize what Jesus is actually saying, and I end up baptizing this person and making them a disciple, I've made them a disciple of a watered down Jesus that you just don't find in the Bible. It just does not exist. But Jesus wants disciples who will follow him. And this doesn't just apply to visitors and unbelievers we're trying to teach. In reality, this often applies more to those of us who grew up in pews. Oftentimes, when I'm teaching somebody who's reading the Bible for the first time in their life, they'll see Jesus and hear Jesus unfiltered, and they'll get it. But if we've grown up in pews, or if we've been attending church for a long time, we tend to see Jesus and hear Jesus through the lens and filters of our religious traditions, or the way we've always said, or the way we've always done it. And as a result, we miss some of the core values and fundamental focus and priorities, and end up redefining what it means to follow Jesus and be committed to him. Redefining what a Christian life should look like. We end up wanting Jesus and, right? I want to serve Jesus, and I want fill in the blank. And it's different for all of us. But Jesus says it doesn't work that way. Jesus' demands are extremes. He demands all or nothing. Again, Jesus in effect said, I get all of you or you get none of me. And each one of us has got to take these things seriously. Jesus wants our all. You know, we say that a lot, and it can become just this kitschy phrase that just doesn't have any meaning or substance. But we've got to get this. This isn't kingdom philosophy. This isn't even about shock value. These are absolute imperatives of the Christ who is meaning and intentionally trying to separate the large crowds who are going along with him from the true disciples who are ready to live and die for him. And so each one of us has to ask ourselves, am I among the masses who are eager to go along with Jesus? Or am I a disciple ready to surrender my will, my possessions, my relationships, even my own life if need be, to follow after Jesus? You think about that, you think, well, who can demand so much? Who can ask of me so much? I can't. This isn't... I can't. But Jesus can. Think about some of the pictures we've seen of Jesus in Luke. Jesus is the Christ, as Peter confessed in Luke 9. Jesus is the Son of David, Son of Abraham, Son of God, as we see in his genealogy in Luke 3. Jesus is he who baptizes in the Holy Spirit and fire, as John testified in Luke 3. Jesus is he who gave sight to the blind, made the lame walk, cleansed lepers, made the deaf hear, raised the dead, and preached the gospel to the poor, as we see in Luke 7. Jesus is he who cast out demons by the finger of God in Luke 11. Jesus is he who suffered and died according to the scriptures, as we see in Luke 23. Jesus is he who, as he died, with his arms stretched out on the cross, kept saying, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." And Jesus is he who raised from the dead 3 days later. And as we're going to read tomorrow in Acts 2, here Peter is on the day of Pentecost, and he says, "He is Lord."